We're going to start with three.
The environment, nope, we got four. Economic Development and Agriculture Division, from here on known as the EDAS, so I don't have to say that every time. For Wednesday, February 18th, 2015, will come to order. Today we have the Bowser in front of us and Executive Director John Jasky. And go ahead, you got the whole 2 hours if you want it. So.
Well, Senator, all the questions I'm expecting, I'm sure I'll push the limit on it, but I'll go along rapidly, and you can feel free to interrupt me, you or any of the other members, whenever you're ready to do that. Thank you for the opportunity to present the governor's budget. I want to give a little bit of an overview of our agency and the business model we use to achieve conservation. All of our work is done with and through local governments. We have a small organization of agency staff, and we have a large network of local governments that get the work done on our behalf. I mentioned the board. We have a board of directors that's appointed by the governor. They represent citizens, local government officials, and the agency partners that we work with every day, DNR, MPCA, Agriculture, Health, and the University of Minnesota. Our work is focused on projects and practices on the ground.
Before you go any further, you're an executive director, did you get a raise from the governor or no?
Mr. Chair, I did not.
Okay, all right. Okay, just checking. Right. I know, just checking. No, everybody did.
Mr. Chairman, I'll continue. Our agency board members are from various locations around the state. As I said, they represent different perspectives, and that's important to have that integration of local governments, citizens, and agencies working together to set policy and to do the sub-appropriations once your work is done. We have the responsibility to work with and oversee these local governments. There are 89 soil and water conservation districts, 46 watershed districts, of course 87 counties, and 19 metropolitan water management organizations.
So is the 20-member board appointed by the governor?
Mr. Chairman, yes, they are. And the four-year terms.
Is it based on people applying for it, or how does it work? Because I don't see anybody from northeastern Minnesota on the board.
Mr. Chairman, to your last question first, or last point, northeastern Minnesota, Brian Nabset from Aiken County would be the closest representative of that part of the state. He's a county commissioner from Aiken County, and they are appointed by persons applying through the open appointments process. The Secretary of State and the governor then selects from that pool of applicants each year. And there's between
Are they staggered terms, or?
Mr. Chairman, yes, they are staggered four-year terms. And so each year there are three or four openings that would be available.
Does he generally reappoint the same people?
Mr. Chairman, I would say that depends. Sometimes yes, but there's also, a person that's served, a term or two already is historically not been reappointed again. So there's a turnover of membership on the board.
Is there any designation in law as to which political party they have to be affiliated with, or?
Mr. Chairman, there is not, although that information is on the open appointments application form.
Okay. All right. Go ahead.
I'll continue. Our core functions, I covered some of these already. We provide, through statutory authority in all of these areas, oversight of local governments. We also implement projects and practices on the ground through those local governments. We also have the responsibility to make sure that we're optimizing the combination of state and federal money that we can bring to Minnesota to do that work, and also using the local resources that those local agencies have to do the work is really an important part of it, technical assistance, financial assistance, and so on and so forth. We have responsibility to review and ultimately approve on behalf of the state local water management plans of these organizations, which describe the work that they're going to do, how they're going to pay for it, and what the benefits and outcomes of that work will be. We have administrative appeal processes to resolve conflicts that are brought to our agency through administrative appeals. I mentioned we use the board as a prior point regarding the combination of local and state policy development. We administer the Wetland Conservation Act, which protects wetlands across the state, and we also facilitate the drainage policy of the state that is in Minnesota Statute 103E.
Do you have your tape measure with you?
Senator, I do not. I have it in my vehicle. I can bring it to your office later if you need to use it again.
Well, we're thinking of just using it right in here right now, but that's okay. Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, I think
we missed that. What was that?
I have one.
You don't have a 50-foot one, though, right?
Tape?
Yeah.
Not 50.
we have them. Come down to my office later, and I'll show you the 50-foot mark so you can... We measured it.
You have to have buffers in your office, Mr. Chair?
Well, there's an indication of where the pheasant will be and not be. So you can come and see my 50-foot mark.
The hardware store nearby, I'm sure you can all find one if you need one. But I think, Mr. Chairman, if my eye is correct and my pace would be better, I think you and I are about 50 feet apart right now. So if that helps anybody else.
I think it's a little bit more than this, okay. But I'm not sure. Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, members, the core functions I talked about, I mean, and all of them involve work on conservation, work on private land. That's one very important distinguishing characteristic of our work is that we work with landowners who own the private property themselves and have to work with their needs and interests and sometimes wishes, and sometimes they're wondering about why we're doing things. We have an obligation to explain to them what we're doing and how it's going to benefit the public, and hopefully they will be also participating in that benefit themselves. As I mentioned before, we spend a lot of our time making sure we have alignment between the federal, state, and local policies and also the appropriations that come from these various sources. As many of you know, there are federal appropriations that come through the Corps of Engineers, the U.S. Department of Agriculture. Most of the EPA money goes through MPC, but we also occasionally use some of that funding. We also have got a partnership with the Department of Military and bringing some conservation dollars to central Minnesota around Camp Ripley. So to the budget piece, and you will have all of this and more in your packets, this shows the agency revenue streams or sources at large. You can see that the largest part of this is the Clean Water Fund, which is for projects and practices that go to the ground through local government units, and we'll come back to that later on in the presentation. I should also point out that of these funds that come through our agency, 85 to 90% of them go out the door to local governments in their project work, and so this budget reflects, you know, all of those different revenue streams, but in total, 90% of our funding from the Clean Water Fund goes out the door to local projects and practices, and on the other funding sources, it's about 85%.
How do we get the federal funds?
Mr. Chairman, the federal funds come through agreements. Some of them are grant agreements. Some of them are, we call them contribution agreements, where the federal agency, in the case of USDA, pays the state to do some work. Their funding goes directly to landowners, and we help make the most of that, often by bringing some state or local funding to that work. So contribution agreements, grants, some contracts, it's various legal forms, but they're resulting in the same thing, which is federal money being passed down to projects and practices that we would align with state and local resources.
And are they, is there some kind of a match required in order to get the federal fund? Is that what the deal is? Or?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, regarding the match, there's a contribution the state has to put in. Often you could describe it as a match. They don't often call it a match, but you have a state responsibility to do the work. We often use a shared services model, so in effect it is a match that the state's providing.
And is further in your presentation, do you have the Outdoor Heritage Fund and the LCCMR bonding amounts? Or?
Mr. Chairman, I do not, but I could cover those. The governor's proposal, as you know, includes the general fund, the federal funds. It includes a Clean Water Fund, but it does not include other funding streams, including Outdoor Heritage, LCCMR, or bonding. So those will be, I can get that information to you in a separate path, or I can talk more generally about it if you have any questions.
What does more generally mean?
Mr. Chairman, the Outdoor Heritage Fund has its own bill that will be coming through, presumably this committee, that is multiple appropriations to multiple organizations for multiple purposes. So that's generally handled through a separate bill. The LCCMR is very similar to that, I believe.
Yeah,
it would
but
be
in regards to your agency, how okay. does that? How is that?
Oh, okay. I can talk about a couple of things. Sure. In the Outdoor Heritage Fund bill, there are, I believe, I'm guessing now, three appropriations specific to our agency, and all of them have to do with conservation easements through a Reinvest in Minnesota program. One has an aim for restoring wetlands, and that will be lined up with some level of effort from the federal government. We also have an appropriation for buying easements around sensitive areas on Wild Rice Lakes or Cisco Lakes in northern Minnesota. And we have an appropriation that is for the area around Camp Ripley, the ACA area around central Minnesota. The LCCMR, I don't have that list with me right off the top of my head. Okay, I know we have some funding in there.
You don't know the figures, so but that's okay. I understand. So you have some projects in these other bills that are not included here. I guess that's mm-hmm. what I'm getting at. Okay.
And Mr. Chairman, I'd be happy to, when those bills are before your committee, talk in more detail about those.
Okay, that's fine. And a quorum is present, by the way. Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, members, I will continue then. This shows, again, in the categories of work where those funds go. And you can see, again, the largest category by far is the local water management for the projects and practices that they do using a variety of sources, the largest of which is the Clean Water Fund. Some budget areas that I'll talk about. We do have the responsibility to assure that the state rules and laws are being adhered to, wetland protection being one of them. We also have responsibility to make sure that the buffer areas along ditch systems that are required also have buffers in. Those are done through reports and proceedings at the local level. Counties and watershed districts send us those. The Wetland Conservation Act is administered also by local governments with state oversight. Training and enforcement and so forth. That law has been in place now for 24 years, so that model has been well tested. I can give you more details on any of these if you'd like to see those. One of the other funding categories that we provide resources to local governments under is something called the Natural Resources Block Grant. This is a combination of funds that is used to help pay for some of the work, not all of the work, mind you. The counties or their delegates, the soil and water conservation districts, in many instances, are required to do these programs, or at least they have an expectation that they will do them to get funding from other grant sources. The water management, shoreland management, the feedlot program, and the SSTS or septic system programs, those are the feedlots and the septic systems are overseen by the Pollution Control Agency, and we pass the money through to the local governments, and they can use these funds a little bit more flexibly because of them being bundled under this block grant. The same is true for the Wetland Conservation Act. I'll show you some on that particular funding stream. These are the historical appropriations. Going back, 4 biennium prior and then the one proposed, you can see there's no change proposed in the governor's budget, and you can see over time that number has come down from, the last 10 years or so. Another responsibility is the local water management authorities. In Minnesota, we have counties taking on water management since 1985 or so. In the metropolitan area, we've had a law since 1982, and then we've had watershed districts also managing water and also having levy authority to do it since the late 1950s. And so we have the responsibility to review and approve their local plans for them to carry out their operations. And I'll come back to an initiative that's in the governor's recommendations to accelerate the watershed approach, which I'll move on and come back to that a little bit later on. We have funding that goes into three program areas. Funding that goes to soil and water conservation districts to do their work. We have some funding that will go to watershed management, and that's the new item that I want to talk about a little bit more later on. And we have some passive funds that go to local organizations. The Red River Basin Commission is an international organization they're operated out of Fargo. They're an organization that can work across the Canadian-U.S. boundary as well as between the states of North Dakota, Minnesota, and South Dakota. We provide them with a base appropriation that is matched by the other states in the province. Area 2 is an area of flood control activity in southwestern Minnesota on the southern side of the Minnesota River off the Prairie Coteau, where they've had a historic problem with flooding, and they've They use bonding money and local money to build flood control projects, and we provide a base appropriation to that organization as well. This shows those appropriations. You can see, obviously, they're not being proposed for any changes this biennium, and you see the 10-year trend has decreased since that period of time. You'll note that and these are small bars, mind you, in this chart, but the Minnesota River Joint Powers Board, it was on this chart up until last biennium when that organization disbanded, and so we no longer have a Minnesota River Joint Powers Authority, which is a group of counties in the Minnesota River that was set up in the mid-1990s to manage water on that watershed basis, but they chose to disband, and therefore the state funding that would have been provided, of course, was no longer needed, so that went away. And there has not been anything that has stepped in to fill that void, but a watershed approach, of course, might be one of those options. As I mentioned, our work is really focused on...
Excuse me, Senator Scalzi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I had a question related, before we get off this Area 2 Flood Control and the Red River Basin Commission, because those are pass-through grants. Are those, like in the Red River area, is that like when we built impoundments and we built some berms? Is that the same thing in Area 2 in southwest Minnesota?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Scalzi, not exactly, but they both focus on flooding. That is true. The Area 2 Flood Control Organization is set up to build flood control projects. The Red River Basin Commission is a coordination body that focuses, yes, on flooding, but also on water quality and other cross-boundary issues. It actually got its start, you know, back in the 70s when North Dakota and Minnesota would, you know, landowners would try and build their dike higher on one side versus the other, so mm-hmm. they would have these very contentious results with pushing water onto each other, and of course pushing it downstream into the Canadian area as well. So this organization was set up to work internationally to prevent and remedy those kinds of issues, and they've also been focusing on water quality in the last 10 or so years, because Lake Winnipeg is a very problematic lake for water quality.
So I guess what I was getting at, in the Area 2 in southwestern Minnesota, I'm wondering if it's comparable, whereas in the Red River area there were no wetlands left to hold the water, so we built impoundments and berms. And are we doing that in Area 2 for the same type of reason? There's no way to hold the water other than to do it through government grants?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Scalzi, you know, in both areas, they are building projects to hold water. They're using a combination of local, state, and federal funding for those projects. In some cases, they're doing wetland restoration, but more of the time, they're building flood control projects that can hold water, and they've got structures at the outlet that can be used to lower the water and hold water during certain times of the year to prevent flood damages first and foremost. But certainly, wetland restoration contributes to flood, you know, attenuation as well.
Thank you.
Go ahead.
A few more categories of funding. The Soil and Water Conservation Districts also get project dollars to do a base level of effort for getting these kinds of things accomplished on the ground: erosion control, buffers, feedlots, et cetera, cooperative weed management programs. You can see that number is also not being proposed for any changes. You can also see that there's been a diminution of those dollars and that go to soil and water conservation districts over the last 10 years. And they don't have the ability to raise their own revenue, as they have no taxing authority, so they're reliant on the state funding and whatever they can provide from a county perspective. And many of the counties are doing that, but not as consistently as we probably would like to see. So their funding has diminished over the last 10 years, and you can see that in the chart here. And then finally, the permanent resource protection. We talked about using our Reinvest in Minnesota, or RIM program, to do that. And, Mr. Chairman, you asked about some of the projects that the Outdoor Heritage funding provides, and as do other funding sources, including clean water and bonding for restoring wetlands, as Senator Scalzi asked about, protecting those sensitive environmental areas around wild rice lakes, where you've got a very sensitive habitat area. Buffers, we talked about that a little bit already, maybe some more later on. And then the Army compatible use buffer around Camp Ripley. And you can see that these easements are all over the state. Yes, more of them are in the parts of the state where we have more private land. That's what our agency focuses on. So that's why you see the activity over the last 20-some years that has secured these conservation easements in these places. Then we have a category for agency administration and operations. We have conservation experts in the field. We have hydrologists, biologists, engineers, and we have many of those also working in local offices. So we provide training, technical training, which you see here in the top slide or top photo. We also every year carry out what's known as the Bowser Academy, where we bring in 400 or so local staff to get updated on the latest program guidance and techniques. And we have auditors and fiscal managers, too, because every dollar we put out there has to be accounted for, both transparently as well as making sure the money is going for the purpose it was appropriated for. And we do audits of our local programs as part of that. This just describes some of those items that are in the agency operations category. There are four of them highlighted at the bottom here, which are change items in the governor's budget. The Disaster Recovery Assistance Program actually has already gone through in, I guess it was Senate File 1, and that additional funding for responding to the 2014 summer flooding has been put out the door already. That money has been appropriated and now is going out to meet those unmet needs. There was, as all agencies had in the governor's budget, a 1.8% compensation-related increase. We also had a one-time adjustment of, I think it was about $68,000 for a group of retirements that are coming through. And then we had, and this is a no-cost item, the establishment of a conservation easement stewardship account to be able to hold money into a small amount of money into an account that will over time be used when conservation easement stewardship work was needed, monitoring, enforcement, that sort of thing. Okay, and you can see here the agency operation funds. There is a small increase because of that 1.8% that I just described that would be above what we had in the last funding, but not back to where it was in 10 years ago. And then you can see overall the general fund, this is across agency operations, but most importantly to the local governments that receive these funds for their work. This is going back a little further than just those 10 years. This is going back, about 10 plus now, I guess, if we look at the current biennium or biennium ahead. These are actual dollars in from the general fund, and if you factor in an inflationary aspect of cost of living and so forth, that number actually is about 35% less than it was 10 years ago. So that's why some of our local governments are asking for more help. And, at this point, there won't be a lot to provide, but we will be working with them on alternatives to find ways to keep their operations healthy and sustainable.
So is any of this money being made up with LCCMR money or Outdoor Heritage money or...
Ms. Chairman, I don't believe that's the case because, the funding that is coming from Outdoor Heritage or even from the Clean Water is really used for projects and practices that go to things on the ground. We put the money out there. That does get used by local governments, but there are a lot of that money is for either land rights or for contractors or design firms to do some of that work. So the money is getting out there. There's no question about that, the additional funding from the Legacy Amendment, but it is not able to be used for operational purposes at the local or state level because that, of course, is what the language allows for.
So in 2004, were there more people working for Bowser, or was it just you were getting more projects done?
Ms. Chairman, in 2004, there were less people working for Bowser than there are now. Another question that might be related to that would be, what would be the case at the Soil and Water Conservation District level or county level or Watershed District level? And I wouldn't be able to answer that, but it's a good question. I might be able to find out a few more facts about that.
So the general fund money that you had in years gone by was not used for personnel. It was used for getting out to counties or getting out to the districts? Is that what you were doing with it, or what?
Mr. Chairman, it was both, right? It was, our funding historically has been somewhere between 85% and 90% go out to to local governments for their work and their projects and practices. That hasn't changed. And I will say, you know, that the legacy funding certainly has accelerated and made a lot more work on the ground possible. There's no question about that. But remember that it has to be used, you know, necessary and direct, project by project, practice by practice. So there, we can't provide a lump sum to a local government for their base work. They have to, they're only able to get the funding if they receive a competitive grant to do that kind of work.
Senator Ingebretson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And on that same vein, my question to you, Mr. Jasky, would be, do you think over the 5 years now of funding for legacy funding has affected your general fund budget? Do you think that's affected it negatively?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Ingebretson, that's a tough question. I mean, we did go through, as you all know, a very challenging time in this state, you know, a few years ago with general fund and everything else that was affected by the recession. So at this point, it's very hard to tease that part of it out of the equation. If you look at this chart, of course, you know, going back to prior to that time, you can see that reduction occurred right around then, obviously. We haven't gotten back to where we were. I can grant you that with this chart showing the facts about that. So, but I'm not sure of the cause and effect at this point, Senator.
Yeah, thank you. And for a follow-up, just in general, watershed districts are looking at the possibility, maybe this is a question directed to the chairman of the Tax Committee, for the authority of taxing watershed districts. I'm sure you know that that's probably out there, no pun intended, floating around in the world of water here, but it certainly has been talked about. Would you be in support of something like that?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Ingebretson, it's the soil water conservation districts that are looking for the taxing authority. Watershed districts currently would have levy authority for projects that are petitioned for, I believe.
So but the soil water conservation districts for that
levy authority, yes. And did you want me to ascertain the possibility of that happening?
Right.
Well,
0 to 10.
I have a committee that makes those decisions. My personal philosophy on it is that it might not be as good an idea because they currently have the ability to work with the county board. We do have some proposals that I think they might find interesting, including making their levy a special levy so it would be separated out on the tax return. Been working with Mr. Knopf on that. The other thing that I did commit to them, and I have signed on to a bill, would be to triple the amount of money they get from the state for their water quality block grants. And at some point I was going to ask Mr. Jasky what he thought of that proposal and how he thought it might impact the relationship that Bowser has with the local soil water conservation districts. But
that
would be my response to the levy.
And real quickly to that, some counties treat their watershed districts differently. You know that more so than anybody, I'm sure. So that was my only concern. So thank you.
Well, and to that point, Mr. Chair and Senator Ingebretson, in the conversations I've had with the folks from the soil water conservation districts, when I was a county commissioner, I was the soil water conservation district representative that went to, as a county board member, went to all their board meetings. And when the county board was doing its budgeting and levying, I advocated for them. And what I've been proposing is that they should, as elected members of the soil water conservation district, get engaged with their county commission, get a good board representative to come to their meetings. So when the county is doing this, and now if we are able to make this change where they can have a special levy, that the county board would be fully informed because that member would be involved. And I think it would be a good action for them to take.
Thank you. You want Mr. Jasky to answer your question now, Senator Scoy, or you want to wait?
Sure, whatever he wants to do.
Do you remember the question?
I haven't seen anything specific, Mr. Chairman, but what Senator Scoy described was, it sounded like an additive component to the Soil and Water District and or county operations to do the programs that have been, you know, languishing currently. And I think if that's the case, I think it makes a lot of sense.
Thank you.
that yet, but I'm sorry, things have more.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, I'll continue then. We have, in Minnesota, we've got a lot of information about, you know, what to do and how to do it. We are very much invested in using those tools, using the science that's been developed over the last, you know, half dozen or longer years, particularly in the water quality front, but also in the habitat area, to make good decisions. And a lot of information that's in these statewide endeavors has real meaning when it gets adopted into a local plan. These are just ideas until actually somebody takes them, puts them into their work-a-day world and makes them happen. And so that's what our agency is focused on, is taking these big ideas, these important facts, important ideas, and putting them into action. The Clean Water Fund is, you know, the primary way that that's happening now. You know, you just described some of the general fund challenges, but we have in the governor's budget, you know, a number of various programs with various dollar amounts in them. The one characteristic that cuts across most of these is that they are competitive grants for one-time projects or practices. And so, you know, that's really, really important. It really accomplishes a lot. And, you know, I don't know where we'd be without it, to be honest. But it has made a big difference, and it will make a longer-term difference as we start to add more of these projects to the mix. And I'm going to show you a few examples. These are just numbers with program names behind them. You're going to see this in the budget documents that you have or will be getting in bill form at some point. I'll highlight a couple of them. You know, we heard a little bit already about, you know, buffers, and you can see there are some dollars proposed in the governor's budget, clean water budget, for that already, conservation easements. We also have, Mr. Chairman, you asked about leveraging federal funding. We are in the process of trying to work out an agreement with USDA on something called the Conservation Reserve Enhancement Program, where they would bring dollars that we could use our state funding to help, you know, advance the cause, to put wetland restorations on the landscape, to hold water, to treat water before it moves downstream. We've got a number of other pieces in here. One of them is the One Watershed, One Plan Endeavor, that the counties, the soil and water conservation districts and watershed districts have worked very, very hard on over the last few years to make a policy that makes sense for Minnesota going forward. We'll talk a little bit more about that. So these are the budget line items that are in the governor's recommendations. And Mr. Chairman, you asked about staffing. The Clean Water Fund, there are no staffing increases for the general fund because there are no funding increases, period. We have the 1.8%, which is not going to be able to cover even the existing staffing costs. The number is a zero-based number in the Clean Water Fund. Is 35.9 FTEs are projected for the Clean Water Fund part of our work. And if you have any questions about that, I can certainly answer them now. And I can tell you what it's for. There, it represents about an increase of, I'm remembering 10 to 12, is the recollection that I have in my head, largely for these three particular parts of that proposal, you know, including, you know, the auditing and the financial oversight and reporting that comes with that.
So have you ever calculated the impact of the local jobs that the clean water projects actually generate to the local economy of where it's being done?
Mr. Chairman, that's a really good point, and I, at some point I can share with you some federal analysis on that. You know, these dollars go on all these, you know, they're competitive grants that go to local governments, and then they, you know, hire people to do the work, you know, designers and installers and seed vendors and you know, trucks hauling things and what have you. We had some analysis done on the easement part of it, where we were doing some of the same things, restoring wetlands, basically. And we had a study that I'm not going to use the number off the top of my head because I don't remember it. I'll share with you that analysis done by USDA. It showed the jobs per dollar spent in this kind of work, and it does multiply in the local communities. There's no question about that. You know, obviously, we're doing this work on private land, and we have to make sure that the landowner is compensated, too, in some cases, for giving up their land. If you're going to restore a wetland, you have to make sure that they are compensated for the land rights as well. But we can get you that information about the turnover of the dollars locally.
Senator Ingberts.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And when you're on that same, there you go. One more back. I'm sorry. The
Lemmer Forward.
The riparian buffer permanent conservation easement. Mm-hmm. No real secret about the word buffer recently. Yeah, in fact, you and Commissioner Winter, Commissioner Vag were in talk to me, the $12 million you're talking about here, is that having anything to do with that new initiative coming forward, or can you talk a little bit about that? I think the committee's quite interested in what's happening there.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Ingebrigtsen, if you wouldn't mind, I would like to just come back to that subject. Sure. Because these numbers in the governor's recommendations were put together well before his announcement on that, so there may be some adjustments that will be needed, and we can talk about, you know, what we know about what it is and how it could work, and there's more to come on that, certainly. So I'll defer your question. Mr. Chairman, members, I just wanted to point out that, you know, although the Clean Water Fund has, been a very important part of getting work done on the ground, I want to show you each year we put out a request for proposals, and here's what we get. We get a list of We ask local governments to send us their top two or three projects that are ready to go right now. We don't want all of them. We want just the top two or three, because we know that we're only going to be able to fund somewhere around 20% of them. And this has been a trend that's, not changed. The more we get, the more, the need reveals itself to be. And I think not that those two are happening as a cause and effect, but because those local governments, through the planning that they've been doing, using the science the state's provided, have been identifying the projects that need to get done to do the most good to clean the water up across the state or prevent it from getting bad in the first place. That's also a very important part of their work. And so we have a very high demand for these dollars, and, it sounds like a good thing, and I guess it is. From my point of view, it's very frustrating to tell, 8 out of 10 that they're going to have to go home with nothing after they've worked hard to get those grants to us. And to Senator Scully's point earlier, if you don't have the money to even put the proposal together, how are you supposed to get the money that's only going to be available through this competitive process? You have to, and you don't get anything if you apply and aren't successful. There's no, stipend for having tried, right? So we have to have that base capacity there just to be able to get to the point of having good proposals to fund through that particular funding source. And that funding source only allows funding to be used when a grant is awarded. So that's
Senator Scoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Jasky, so these are a result of the 5 and 10 year water plans that local units have put together?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Scoy, yes, they use those plans to generate the list of proposals they send to us. And this chart actually just shows the black line represents the top two or three that each local government derives from their plan and sends to us in that particular year. And the blue line indicates how much money we're able to provide them based on the funding we get to the Clean Water Fund.
And, Mr. Chair, Mr. Jasky, do you know, are these plans connected to the MPCA's effort to do their best management practices and their reduction in silt, and I can't remember what they call that, where they got the, but are these related to those then?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Scoy, yes, they are. You're probably referring to TMDL plans. They're really water quality plans, and they allocate, the responsibilities to clean up the water in there, although, the only place they can compel it is through the regulatory components of their permitting. That science that is being, used to generate those plans is what the locals then turn into action plans for doing the work to clean up the water. So they are very much related. And I have to give the PCA a lot of credit, actually. They've, in the last few years, I worked at the local level too before I came to the state, and I used to see all these reports get written and all the science get done, and wonder, why are you just sending it to the EPA? Can't we make use of it here in Minnesota? And to Commissioner Stein and staff's credit, they've taken that requirement of the feds and turned it into something much more useful for Minnesota. So we get a report from them that you can actually use for something. It covers not just the one parameter here and one parameter there. It looks at the whole watershed. It looks at protection. So they've been doing a good job with that science, and then the locals turn it into action plans.
Thank you, Mr. Jasky.
So is any of that money that we spend on these projects a result of law changes that we made that are requiring local units of government to do things that they otherwise might not do? Like emissions from wastewater treatment plants or something like that?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, you know, the items you described, you know, for local governments, the cities and so forth that run municipal operations, they are permitted parties, just like an industry would be, and they have to provide, you know, the treatment for that discharge that the permit requires, and those permit standards have been evolving over time. No question about that. What our work is focused on the, you know, we use the term that no one likes to use, the non-point, you know, the non-permitted activities, the general landscape where water's running off when it snow melts or the rain comes and the land is unprotected. That's where our work really focuses. It also focuses in, you know, maybe more so in northern Minnesota on dealing with the threats that could otherwise take a high-quality water resource and have it, you know, go in a negative direction. So staving off a threat because, you know, keeping it from going bad's a better investment than trying to fix it after it's gone bad. So it's all of those kinds of things, and the science that we use, you know, helps us predict those things, and the action plans then tell us which ones can be done most cost effectively by whom and where over a typically a 10-year period. Give me a few examples, you know, and we have many partners on these projects, you know. I mean, there's the local folks. There's also, you know, we have partnerships with the nonprofit world, with Conservation Corps of Minnesota and Iowa, with Ducks Unlimited, with Pheasants Forever, and, of course, the many contractors and, you know, designers that work on these projects. Here's this tonight. We've got, you know, hundreds of these, and, you know, at some point, you know, we can show you many more of them if you're interested. Here's a project. This is Lake McCarran. This is the metropolitan area. You know, we have very precise ways to predict the benefits of these projects. And so here's one lake, you know, and it, you know, we can measure the predicted, you know, phosphorus reduction per year. And that one project with this one grant would solve, you know, 39% of that problem. And so if we did, what, three more of these, we'd be done with that particular problem on this lake, you know, if you could keep it that simple. You know, we also look at groundwater type work, and sometimes the quantity and quality are very much tied together. Here's a project in Wadena County, the Soil and Water Conservation District. You know, not a lot of money, right? I mean, these dollar amounts, even though they're, you know, multiple millions, in the end they get doled out in sometimes very small increments. Here is a $91,000 project that helps two things really at the same time. One is it helps the producer using his irrigation equipment to reduce the amount of water they're going to have to put on the crop, saves them some money from pumping and, you know, other energy sources. It also saves the water that would otherwise be taken out of the ground for somebody else to use if they need it, and also helps to reduce the amount of nitrogen that is going to leach into the water, because if you don't put the water on top of the land when it's not needed, it's less likely to pull the nitrogen down into the soil and back through into the water column. So three things here with a small grant. Saving water, helping a producer be more efficient with their operation, and, you know, keeping the nitrogen out of the groundwater where it's very, very difficult and expensive to get out once it's there. Prevention is always cheaper. Yeah. Here's a project, Little Rock Lake, central Minnesota. I think this is Benton County. I drive by this thing all the time when I go back to our farm in central Minnesota, but it doesn't always look this bad, fortunately, but it is a lake with a serious water quality problem. And here's a project from a couple years ago. You know, they have a phosphorus issue. That's what's causing all this algae to grow. And, of course, the lakeshore owners and everybody else that wants to use it, along with the wildlife, are impaired with that problem. So this lake, with this grant, they've got a goal in that plan that I just described more generically, and Senator Scoey mentioned. The goal is to reduce 10,585 pounds of phosphorus from entering this lake. And this project is going to take care of 11% of that problem. So there's, you know, more to do. But they can't do it all at once either, which is, you know, you know a lot of money in a short period of time isn't as helpful as more consistent funding over a longer period of time, typically. Here's a project up in northwestern Minnesota in Carlton County. They have a unique geology there. They've got a soil type known as red clay that the glaciers put there, you know, and they've got, and it's very fragile soil. And they took this project, you know, that was actually an old dam that somebody had built to try and hold the water back so it wouldn't erode. There's also a trout stream that this water, I don't think this part right here is a trout stream, but parts of this water course are a trout stream, and they went in and retrofitted that old structure to hold the water back and to, you know, keep the sediment from getting into the stream, both for protecting Lake Superior, ultimately where this goes, and also, or the bay, actually the estuary, you know, the St. Louis estuary, which is on the headwaters of course, Lake Superior. And they also were able to, get, you know, accomplish some trout habitat too. Now, they didn't get outdoor heritage money to do the trout work. They just did this clean water project to make sure the trout were going to be happy enough in this stream to thrive, you know. So that's where sometimes people ask, well, aren't these two things related, you know, habitat or aquatic habitat and clean water? And they absolutely are. But we've got, you know, constitutional divisions of money we've got to pay attention to too. So we do that. And now here's a list of projects that have been funded, you know, since, I guess this time period describes 2010 through 2014. And they are, you know, all over the state. Obviously, you know, there aren't as many in the Rainy River watershed because it's largely public land. And we believe that, by and large, the Forest Service and the DNR and others that are responsible for that property are taking good care of it so it's not causing water problems. The watershed approach, I mentioned this a little earlier, you know, we have been working on the counties, the soil and water conservation districts, watershed districts. You can see here the county boundaries underneath this. This is the Yellow Medicine River in southwestern Minnesota, and these are, you know, there are, you know, 81 watersheds thereabouts around the state. You can see it involves, you know, half a dozen counties and soil and water conservation districts and a watershed district too, and they've embarked on, based on some policy that the legislature passed, Mr. Chairman, I think it was 3 years ago, 2 years ago, I'm trying to recall now, and that policy is going to probably see some further evolution this year because we have to get through a time period of about 10 years of a transition to get watershed approach being used all over the state, not forming watershed districts necessarily. That's a process already allowed or prescribed in law, and it's petitioned through a local mechanism to the state. We also, as I mentioned, are looking at trying to deal with some water quality and habitat issues too across the southern and western part of the state. We are exploring a conservation reserve enhancement program proposal with the federal government to bring some of their resources, considerable resources, to Minnesota to help us tackle wetland restorations and buffer areas in this particular part of the state. At least that's the way we're proposing it right now. There's also some groundwater protection areas that are important in this part of the state as well. So that's a work in progress, but we are anticipating that that will happen in the course of the next year or so. Soil health, soil loss is an issue that we need to pay very careful attention to. I don't have any facts on this, but in my opinion, you know, in the world, Minnesota has two things in combination that are going to make this place the desire of many others in the future, and that is we have a combination of fresh water and productive soil that is hard to find anywhere else in this planet. You know, if you don't have, you got a lot of water, you don't have the good soil, and vice versa. You know, so we have two things that are a tremendous asset for, you know, food, of course, energy production to some extent. So we're going to need to make sure we pay attention to that. So here's a couple pictures just showing, you know, the soil health on the upper right. You know, this is a conservation tillage practice. You know, here you don't have a specific structure to build. You just use equipment that's designed to put the seed in the ground or on top of the stubble that's there the year before. And this is becoming a more common way of holding water on the land. It also helps us increase the organic matter of the soil. A 1% increase in organic matter allows us to hold another inch of water in the soil itself, so you don't have to build a structure to hold it. And it also gives us more productive results in terms of the cropping coming out of that. You can see in the... Mr. Chairman.
Would you repeat 1% increase in... organic material allows you to, would you repeat that, please?
It'll, yeah, Mr. Chairman, Senator Scully, this is, you know, this is an average, you know, because all soils are different, as you well know. But if you increase your organic matter 1%, that can hold another inch of water in that soil profile, is what we've seen the research show. That's, you know, close enough for this sort of discussion anyway. And that's important, you know. Now, having the water in the soil at the right time is really what also is super critical, right? Because if you're an egg producer, you want the water in that soil profile when the crop is growing. You probably don't want it, at least near the top, when you're trying to get the crop in the ground, you know. And the same is true for construction operations and everything else, you know. So being able to manage water predictably is really, really important for production as well as for conservation purposes. You can see in the lower left there, we got a problem, right? Somebody is not taking care of their soil very well, and they're not, you know, they're having others downstream be affected by it too, which is another challenge because all that sediment and everything in it is down in the ditch or the lake or the stream or whatever's down below, down gradient. And, you know, you'd like to think this person, you know, did this by accident, but, you know, maybe they did, maybe they didn't. It might be a renter too, for all we know. I mean, we have in Minnesota, a lot of egg producers, actually half of them now are renters, and, you know, they're renting land, and so they may not be as focused on the long-term consequences of how that land gets used. Now, they didn't, this could have been obviously a, you know, a very large storm that they wouldn't have projected either. You know, the climate issues are becoming more of an issue with flooding and size of storms and whatnot, but this site could be managed with a couple of different practices, waterway or a grade stabilization or something like that. Buffers. Yes, buffers are an important practice. And where we have them, they provide a number of benefits, water quality being first and foremost. And they can be put in just about anywhere with, you know, a little bit of care and attention. You know, it you can see in the right-hand side of this slide, you know, there's a perennial water that, you know, doesn't have a buffer requirement, and someone is, you know, using the inverse slope of the bank to put in their crop and spray and so forth. Now, this is going to cause some problems, obviously, if you get a big rainstorm and, you know, somebody downstream hopefully is, you know, got a buffer so we can help save some of that. But I think it's an issue of equity as well. You know, this living downstream from that is not probably, you know, something you'd like to do. And being responsible for your own property is something we need to make sure people are paying attention to. Some good buffers you can see there on the left side. You know, there's the one at the top has got a variety of species in it, forbs included, you know, the pollinator habitat and other things that natural buffer area between the water and the land really contribute to. That one obviously has some significant habitat benefits as well, depending on everything else being equal, I guess. In the lower left, you know, that's a ditch system. That's actually a public ditch. I believe that's Swift County. Where they purposely put a meander in the bottom of the ditch so that the water can move around and help. It provides some treatment when it contacts the vegetation. It also provides a bit of flood attenuation. But yet when a big flood comes or a big rain, the ditch can hold most of that water and transmit that water. And it's also got, you know, at least enough vegetation along that bank to hold the bank in place and keep it stable. You don't see raw soil here in this particular picture. Earlier, I think Senator Ingebrigtsen asked about the buffer initiative where the governor's proposal is at. As you know, we're meeting with legislators. We had a stakeholder meeting last week with the agricultural interests. We had one yesterday with the conservation environmental interests, and we're having one more on Thursday, tomorrow, with the local governments who would be the ones doing, you know, most of the implementation work. So we are working on outreach to those organizations, and then we will have at some point shortly thereafter hopefully a something more specific about how this would work. And of course we have to figure out what it's going to cost as well, and I know this committee is very interested in both of those things, and we'll be back here as soon as we can to give you those details. But I'd be happy to take any questions or comments about that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And when I look at the photos you have here, just maybe for the benefit of the committee, and the one on the bottom left, where you have the stream meandering through there, when you talk about buffer strip, that really doesn't start until it gets up on the top end of that. Mm-hmm. So I see fields there now. Is that correct? Is that a fair statement with regards to the most current talk of buffer strip? It'd be the high water mark?
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chairman, yes. I'll stand up, actually, and just point to what you're thinking.
That would be the start. That would be,
Mr. Chairman, I think, you know, this example, Mr. Chairman and members, is a what's called a two-stage ditch. And so it's a project that was built so that you wouldn't need as big a buffer because some of the buffer is actually in the wide channel itself, right? The water gets out of the little channel, and it has a buffer adjacent to it, so some of the buffer is actually in the channel itself. But you raise a good point, Senator, that we need to have a clear mechanism to do the measuring from if the number is going to be 50 feet or whatever the number ends up being.
And just a couple, thank you, Mr. Chair. And so we get into the world of tiling, which has gone on for years in the ag community, and for obviously good reasons to drain their raise their productivity. So is there any, if that water is running from there into a managed stream managed by the DNR or the federal government, which I understand is where the buffer strips are going to be talked about, is there going to be some kind of a proposal to have to leave X amount of area around that buffer strip where that water is running into? Is that part of the buffer strip proposal at all from the administration? Do you know? I don't know.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Ingberson, at this point, I don't have an answer for you. I will agree with you that, you know, we need to make sure that the right practice is in the right spot to do the water quality treatment. There's no question about that. And where you described, you know, a tile intake, for example, bringing the water in and then it being passed, you know, subsurface into the ditch system, that's a site where a buffer, presumably all by itself, wouldn't be as useful as it might be in some other places where you have sheet flow of water coming off the landscape on the surface. So, but at this point, I don't have an answer for you as to what our proposal might look like.
So just one more, if I could, Mr. Chair. So then, I've heard different numbers. How many total miles of buffer are we talking about in the state, and how many are now being buffered? I mean, some of the, as you know, are being buffered 50 plus. Actually, there's some areas that are probably 150, 200 feet of buffer. And would the consideration of the committee that's putting together the proposal give credit to the ag community, to the farmer, if he has a 150-foot buffer through a particular area, and then it maybe narrows down to a 30. So are there any averages being talked about at all?
Mr. Chairman, to your question about the averaging, we are certainly thinking about that, and I think it's going to be important to have something like that for, as you described, you know, cases where you already have a buffer or where you've got obstacles in the way, roads and other things that you, of course, wouldn't be able to necessarily have an exact number to fit. You have to fit the practice to the landscape. Your earlier question was about sort of the scale of the numbers. Let me just use these, I guess, and you can go further if you like. But if we had perfect enforcement of all the buffer requirements, which are twofold, that would be about 30% of our perennial waters would have a buffer. And I say that because I think there's a pretty common misunderstanding that under the ditch law, the one-rod buffer, the only requirement to have a one-rod buffer is when a ditch has had something called a redetermination of benefits since in a date prior or post 1977. Mr. Knopf can correct me if I'm mistaken about that date, but that's, I believe, the date. So a ditch that had this legal proceeding since 1977 has to have a one-rod buffer, and that only represents 20% of all ditches. So 4 out of 5 ditch miles don't have any buffer requirement in law. The 50-foot requirement currently in law in the shoreland areas is, you know, somewhere around 30% of the remainder. So we don't have a requirement for buffers on all perennial waters currently.
So just really quickly here. So currently there's no law. It's a rule right now. Came down from the federal government, correct? The DNR's rule.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Ingberson, it's a state rule requirement that the locals are asked or required to put into their local zoning code. It's not a federal requirement. It's a state rule requirement from the DNR Minnesota Chapter 6120 rules.
Senator Westrum.
Mr. Chair, a few questions kind of following the same line, but on the buffer strip, Mr. Jaski, we had several leaders referred to as emerging leaders from the Red River Valley here today, and this many of them are involved in agriculture. And so we talked about this issue, but I found out this morning from one of them that right now their understanding is there's only three counties that have full enforcement of the buffer rules, or that at least was the case not so long ago. Grant County being my home county being one of those. What is the status of enforcement, and how does a county become an enforcement county right now where most others aren't enforcing the buffer rules? And so how does that happen, and who are they?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Westrum, you're correct about Grant County. Actually, I think there are six of them that I have information about. Okay. Grant County, and maybe the three were in the Red River Valley. The other one was Otter Tail County, is embarking on that same effort. Dodge County, which is in South Central Minnesota, Dakota County, which is in the southern part of the metropolitan area, Blue Earth County, of course, right where the river, Minnesota River bends, in the Mankato area, and I missed one.
Olmsted.
Olmsted, thank you, Senator. Olmsted County, of course, Rochester. So we know that those six have done it, and they've done it basically of their own responsibility. You could say their own initiative, I suppose. But the characteristics of it are as follows. Each of them have done it this way. And I think Grant County, Senator Russell, was one of the first to do it. And I think they were very successful because they were methodical. They had, they looked at the landscape. They sent communication to the landowners, asked them to think about, putting a buffer in. They offered them choices about how to do it, including enrollment in some of the federal or state conservation programs. They followed up. They used the planning and zoning administrator, Greg Lillimon, I believe was the person mm-hmm. doing it, and Joe Montoni, the Soil and Water District Administrator. They worked together on this approach, and they got people to do it. And I think what they told me, and maybe they told you the same thing, maybe I remember it exactly, but they told me they had three landowners that gave them some difficulty in the end of it. So they worked it all through, and they had three landowners that were still not willing to fully comply. I think the same experience has been, the case in the other counties. They've been doing it systematically with a combination of regulatory and voluntary options.
So when you say locally, who's funding that? Then the county commissioners? Mm-hmm. Or the Soil Water Conservation Board, or who?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman.
Or is there some Bowser or DNR money that's gone that direction?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Wisdom, good question. The way I understand it in Grant County, they were doing it largely with their own resources. The state provides a very small contribution to under the block grant program for counties to implement their shoreland zoning effort. It's a few thousand dollars a year, so that wasn't clearly the single source for it. Mm-hmm. They also were able to use some of the federal and state conservation dollars to help landowners do the work on their own property. In the case of Otter Tail County, we did give them, Bowser did, a grant to help them get that effort started and continued because they have a very large water resource base in their county, and they were going to be on a 9-year plan unless we helped them to speed it up a little bit. So that was a project that they sought from the state and were able to compete successfully and get an award for that in those grants that I talked about earlier.
Okay. And you just mentioned, and I think maybe you had the answer in there, but could you repeat it or elaborate? Let's use Grant County for the example, or any of the six. They're enforcing what kind of setbacks on what kind of waterways? You said 4 out of 5 of the ditch systems aren't the 50-foot buffer doesn't apply, or a one-rod buffer doesn't apply. Shoreland is 50-foot, meaning just lakes or rivers and lakes. What does it apply, and what's it cover right now, for example, in Grant County?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Westerman, Grant County, the requirement for the 50 feet is along public waters, which would be, as you described, a lake or a river or a larger stream. That's where they're enforcing that 50-foot requirement. The one rod requirement is only along what are designated as public ditch systems, and Grant County was not focused on that, although they did work with landowners on areas where they wanted to put a buffer in that was for example, more than a one rod, because the conservation funds would require more than a one rod requirement for that. So,
okay. So, on that same related, the other thing I found out, and it's, I think, at least informational for us as we contemplate moving forward, because many of these rules are in place. It's just a matter of when a county would decide to enforce it, or if we put more millions more in enforcement. My assumption is there's going to be some enforcement grants that would go to local counties. Those of us that have already done this should at least participate in that, if that's the case, or else that's kind of a bigger discussion. But where I'm going with this question is the person I was, farmers I was talking to this morning from the emerging leaders, what they've shared with me is the CRP rules don't allow less than a 66-foot buffer. And so in order to enroll in CRP, you actually have to put a bigger buffer in than 50 feet. Otherwise, there is not really a program, and then they have to hay it or graze it next to the river and hope that pays off. Now, in the one case, they were explaining that that's probably their best land is along the river, so to not be able to farm it is problematic.
Did you take that?
But I just think it's insightful. If the CRP rules require 66 feet, we're, and that might be the main source of a program money or dollars. There's kind of an inconsistency here, and we could be requiring bigger buffers as a practical matter if that's the case. Is that your understanding, too?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Westrom, yes, you're correct. I mean, the CRP program is a very, very important option for landowners that want to have a buffer or are being asked to have a buffer. And one other point you made, which is very, very important as well, is that we believe that it's going to be we don't want to have the landowner become ineligible for CRP, for example. And that was one of the very careful things that Grant County did when they communicated to these landowners, was giving them a chance to get a buffer in before they were deemed to be noncompliant, because then they become ineligible for the CRP program. So that's a very practical point you made. Thank you.
Senator Osmick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To the 50-foot buffer rule, is it the intent and the direction that the committee is going is to enforce a 50-foot buffer rule on every public waterway? As you previously discussed, it sounds like that's what the intent is. Where I'm going with this is, in my district, I have this lake called Lake Minnetonka, and if you put a 50-foot buffer, you're taking away riparian rights from a lot of land that currently people are using for recreational purposes or for their homes. Is that the intent, or is there going to be some modification for more urban areas or recreational properties?
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chairman, Senator Osmick, we don't have anything specific yet. At this point, what we're looking at or thinking about is perennial waters, you know, perennial water courses primarily, with a standard that would be perennial vegetation. So if you've got perennial vegetation to help provide the water quality filtration and so forth, then it likely wouldn't require much more, if anything. But we don't have those details yet, so we'll have to come back to the committee, or we're happy to take your points or questions, you know, and consider them. So there isn't a detailed bill yet or anything close to it.
Mr. Chair, well, just to give you some feedback, I've been through this twice in my previous elective experience with a watershed district, and in both cases the watershed district realized that it was unworkable in urban areas. Also, we continue to ask the watershed that I worked with for actual data to explain how a well-maintained lawn where clippings are removed from the area is a better or is not as good a vegetative state as a decaying 5-foot high bunch of flowers and weeds. Because certainly you could make the case that that decay would get into the lake and provide more contaminants biologicals than someone who basically kept their lawn well-maintained all the way to the shoreline. So I would strongly suggest when you're going in this direction that when you're looking at residential and urban properties, one size doesn't fit all, because you will probably find a very significant pushback, at least from me, when you're trying to create a 50-foot buffer and taking away people's rights on particularly urban lakes, because you're basically wiping out their use of their property.
Mr. Chairman, thank you, Senator, for that. I'm very familiar with the Watershed District approach that was contemplated in your district. I'm also we're very cognizant of, you know, the ability of landowners to you know, use their property for what they purchased it for.
Okay, go to the next slide.
Mr. Chairman, and I want to highlight one more issue that's still in the work. We've been spending the last, you know, couple of years working on some options to how to accomplish better wetland mitigation. As most of you know, when wetland areas are needing to be drained or filled because the activity can't avoid them, there's a requirement to mitigate or offset those wetlands someplace else. And in Minnesota, we have a very diverse landscape in terms of wetland resources. The northeastern part of our state is very wetland rich and has always been so, and other parts of the state have had, you know, very few wetlands remaining or didn't have many to begin with. And so we are focusing much of this, you know, around some of the challenges in northeastern Minnesota, putting a wetland on a landscape when one was lost from a draining or a filling project. And I believe we will have something in the supplemental recommendations around this and some policy to go with it. Mr. Chairman, we'd like to come back with your committee at some point and talk about that when it's ready.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Scoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Jasky, is this the initiative that we've been having some conversations about where we would be trying to find a mechanism in order to have the wetland mitigation done where it could do the most important water quality management and not necessarily worry about exact location of the mitigation? Is that what's going on with this that you're thinking you come forward with?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Scoy, yes. We're working very carefully with the federal agencies, the Corps of Engineers in particular, also DNR, as well as some stakeholders to try and figure out how to put a wetland in a place that's going to do some good for a long time and people will value its functionality where it's going to be replaced. We believe there's a mechanism currently in federal law that Minnesota can adapt to work well for our purposes, and I think we will have something here in the next week or so to talk with you about more specifically.
And Mr. Chair, Mr. Jasky, when you have something to share, I'd appreciate it. Come to my office.
Me too.
Let me get close
to everybody
to
on the committee.
Mr. Chairman, members, you know, as I said, you know, there's a lot of little things that have some pretty big results. Local governments are, you know, as I described, and you listened to me describe earlier, they're working on plans and activities that support those plans. Over the last 25 years, you know, there's been a lot of work accomplished, certainly more to do. We very much are paying attention to measuring results, you know, planning, measuring, and showing the results of these dollars and the staff at the local level, along with our agency supporting them, are accomplishing. So we can give you a lot more detail on that. And finally, I just wanted to highlight, you know, this is a map that shows the land ownership in the state of Minnesota. And you can see that, of course, much of it or most of it is privately held. And we also have laid on top of this the impairments that the landscape has revealed through the science that the PCA and DNR and others have been using to check our waters. And it's no coincidence that the private land areas are where we need to spend most of our time dealing with change to improve that water quality, regardless of what its source is. As I said before, hopefully our public lands are being well taken care of by our federal and state partners. That, Mr. Chairman, I will stop and entertain any more questions and try and give you more details you're looking for.
Any further questions of Mr. Jasky? We have, so the only general fund increase that you're requesting is the 1.8%, right, for that the governor's recommending for all the agencies?
Mr. Chairman, that's correct, and a very small related component for retirements.
And it's what, $282,000? Is that?
That sounds about right, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Okay. Any other questions or comments from anybody? All right. Any final?
Mr. Chairman, thank you. We'll look forward to coming back and talking about at least those two other items that we know are still in the works. So
all right.
Appreciate your time.
Okay. Sounds like buffer zones are going to be a big deal. All right. Meeting adjourned.